Thank you, everybody, for coming, and thanks to Hanuman, Sadie, Kokpo, for the music. Today we're starting a brand new series called Controlling Our Reactions. And they're based on the teachings of His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, the founder, Acharya, of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. Happy are those who do not overreact to people. There's an old saying that anger is a gun that shoots the person who aims it. In other words, whoever gets angry, no one is more damaged than the person that gets angry themselves. So if you imagine a fellow shooting a gun at someone else, but most of the damage is done to the shooter rather than to the targets, that would be a good example of what anger does to you. Ask yourself these questions. Do you often regret things you say or do in the heat of emotion? Do you lash out at loved ones and then have to apologize to others for your actions or words? Do you feel surprised at your seemingly uncontrollable reactions? Do you assume the worst about situations or people? Do you withdraw when things get emotionally overwhelming? If the answer to any of those is yes, then you overreact. And according to this, you won't be happy. So you need to learn to stop overreacting. You need to learn to control your reactions in order to be happy. Would you say the fellow on the left is overreacting? Where is the TV remote? And the fellow on the right? I am such a loser. You're overreacting. Lots of people have never won the lottery. A few other examples of overreacting. All right, maybe John was a bit out of order, but there was no need to bite his head off. And I don't know if this is an example of overreacting or not, but I just couldn't resist putting in this picture on the lower right-hand side. I think that was, if not overreacting, maybe just overdoing it a little bit too much. I think that's Karzai. Karzai, is that the name of the fellow who's in charge of Afghanistan? Why is it enough to be in pain when it isn't enough to be in pain yourself and project it upon other people? And here are some not so nice examples of overreaction. The pot is boiling on the stove. The little girl has a black eye because someone overreacted. I mean, what possible fault could attach itself to this little 3 or 4 year old girl? What fault could she have exhibited? So it wasn't really her fault. We know just from the picture that some parent or adult way overreacted. The problem is that we think if we don't react, if we don't go tit for tat, we're not a man, we're not manly, or we're not womanly. Meek is a word in the English language which doesn't have positive connotations. You have this Caspar Miltos fellow who's like a spineless jellyfish. And here's a quote from him. I'm not sure if I can even read it too well here. It says, I'm not going to be able to read that quote. Anyway, Caspar Miltos is the personification of what's supposed to be a meek person. A wife once asked her husband, "Are you a man or a mouse? Squeak up." If we call someone meek, it's a slur. It's certainly not a compliment. But meekness is not weakness. One time in a bar, a Hell's Angel, there were a bunch of Hell's Angels who occupied the bar. It was considered their bar. Another man, truck driver, walked in and he came up to the bar and the Hell's Angels started giving him a really, really hard time and just trying to provoke a fight. And the man, the truck driver, refused to fight the Hell's Angel. He kept his calm. He didn't overreact. He controlled his reactions and he walked out. And after a while, one of the Harley's Angels, Hell's Angels, friends had come into the bar and they were talking. And he said, "Did you see that truck driver that just walked out?" He said, "Yep. He wasn't much of a man, was he?" "No, he wasn't. And apparently he wasn't much of a truck driver either because he just ran over a whole bunch of bikes out front." So meekness is not necessarily weakness. And God shows self-control. And we're created in His image. And so we should also learn to how to control our actions if we're supposed to be godly. There's a classic instance of the Lord controlling His reactions. Many, many thousands of years ago, a demon named Hiranyaksha, the original gold digger, he was digging into the center of the earth in order to extract gold, and he disturbed that which keeps the planet in orbit, and the planet fell down into the bottom of the Garbhodak ocean in which it floats, and it was settling mud at the bottom of this ocean. So, appropriately enough, the Lord incarnated as a boar called Varaha, A boar has tusks, and a boar is expert in rooting things out of dirty places. The Lord assumed this divine form of a boar in order to save the earth from the dirty place that had fallen at the bottom of the universe. And as he was scooping the earth planet and holding on his tusks and rising through the air in order to put the earth back in orbit, he received all these insults from Hiranyaksha as follows. Oh, an amphibious beast, oh fool, oh lowest of the demigods in the form of a boar, just listen to me. You rascal, you have been nourished by our enemies just to kill us. And you have managed to kill a few demons by remaining invisible. But your power is only a sham. So today I shall enliven my kinsmen by smashing your skull with my mace. Certainly very, very provocative words. It would be hard to remain cool and calm if someone was in your face saying these things. But the Lord had a more pressing issue to deal with, and that was the issue of reinstating the earth before then he could take care of the insults that were being directed to him by the demon. So it goes on. The narration tells us, although Hiranyaksha's shaft-like words pained Lord Varaha, he tolerated the pain without reacting, for he saw that the earth was on the end of his tusks. The earth on the end of his tusks was frightened of falling. Instead of fighting at once, Lord Varaha rose out of the water. And as he rose out of the water, Hiranyaksha continued to harass him, continued to hurl insults at him. Are you not ashamed to flee a challenging adversary? What a shameless wretch like you, what are you not capable of? And in this way, finally the Lord put the earth back in his orbit. And then in due time, the fact that he had showed meekness didn't mean he was weak. He just had to take care of one thing, and then he was going to take care of the second thing. So having established the earth in its orbit, then he turned and he engaged in combat with the demon Hiranyaksha. And that combat is described here. They're striking themselves with their huge maces, and each one is enraged with the other. Each one is intent on winning. Their rivalry is keen. There were many, many injuries that they received on their bodies from the maces' sharp points. They were great fighters. And the earth floated helplessly nearby, witnessing this great combat, which looked like two bulls fighting. And finally, the fight is consummated. The demon struck the Lord. You know, the Lord's saying, like, okay, Hiranyaksha, give me your best shot. Give me your best shot, you know. And Hiranyaksha strikes the Lord with his fists, which are like stone hammers. And in return, and it didn't budge the Lord at all. The Lord was not budged at all. And then in return, almost indifferently, he just went like this. He just slapped the demon at the base of the ear and cracked his skull, and he fell down like a great mountain that had been struck by a thunderbolt. His eyeballs bulged out of their sockets, his arms and legs shattered, and he fell like a gigantic tree uprooted by the wind. And then the Lord enjoyed it. See, God gets a little bored by people surrounding him, always singing hallelujahs and hosannas and worshiping him with great awe and reverence. He gets a little bored of that. It gets a little tiresome and repetitive. So once in a while, he'll choose from amongst his devotees in the spiritual world one or two personalities, and he'll ask them to descend on the earth along with him and act the role of his adversaries, just for a little variety, for a little fun. They're actually devotees, but they're asked by the Lord to play the part of demons and adversaries. We've done this when we were kids, you know, a bunch of kids, we're all friends, but there's no tension, there's no drama in us just being all friends. And so we decide, you guys go over there and you guys be the robbers, or you guys be the bad guys, and we'll go over here and we'll be the good guys, and then we'll work out some scenario. And then it becomes much more interesting. So in the same way, the Lord, in order to make things interesting, he delegates certain elevated souls from the spiritual world to descend when he descends and to act as his opponents and adversaries. No ordinary person, obviously, can fight with the Lord like this. Nobody can do that. We're too puny and insignificant. So it has to be an empowered soul descended with the Lord from the spiritual world to give the Lord a good fight. And it says that he enjoyed that. So there are five ways to control your reactions. One thing I like about this series, it'll probably be about three segments, is that each of the five ways to control your reactions has a catchy phrase. And I don't know if you have a notebook or if you have a good memory, or these are also available from the website for downloading. This will actually be very, very helpful, these little catchy phrases. The five ways to control your reactions is that when someone serves you, be understanding, not demanding. And when someone disappoints you, be gentle, not judgmental. When someone disagrees with you, be tender without surrender. When someone corrects you, be teachable, not unreachable. And when someone hurts you, be an actor, not a reactor. So these should be easy to remember. We'll talk about the first one. When someone serves you, be understanding, not demanding. Americans, especially American travelers all over the world, have a reputation for being unpleasable. Unpleasable. Even though they have more affluence and assets than anyone else in the world, somehow or other, they're just never happy. And they're known all over the world as complainers. They just complain, complain, complain. When people in the service industry, in the tourist industry, in the airline industry see Americans come and they say, oh no, you know, oh boy, these are people are unpleasable. So in order to control your actions, it's important that when people serve you, be understanding, not demanding. If someone's a little curt with you, you know, maybe they've had a long day, you know, standing on their feet dealing with unpleasable Americans. You know, maybe you'll be a nice change of pace, you see. Maybe people all day long deal with them and not one of them notices their name tag or recognizes them as an individual with a name. So if you go up and you say, thank you, Madison, or thank you, Leslie, or thank you, Jim, it may make all the difference in their day, just not to any longer be an anonymous face or be treated like an underling or a servant. Someone may need an operation. You know, people that stand on their feet all day long, they get feet problems, they get leg problems, they get hip problems, they get back problems, they get joint problems. Maybe that person is overdue for an operation and their health insurance is not cooperating and they're having a little bit of tension, a little stress in their life. Now I'm having a little stress too because of the conversation that you two are carrying on constantly. So could you just sit and listen? I assume that's what you came for, okay? Thank you very much. And so in this way, you offer people respect. It doesn't cost you anything to notice someone's name and to call them by name. You'll find that not only does it lighten up their day, but it'll actually lighten up your day. You know, if you're too prone to react to them, you might be feeling the effects of a long day. You might be grumpy. You might be tired. And you'll be amazed that if you just take the little extra trouble to look someone in the eye and recognize them and look at their name tag and call them by name, how much that will regenerate and revitalize you in your own day as well. I've had that practical experience. So be interested in what others are doing. Just because we're well off doesn't mean that we're smarter or more privileged. It doesn't mean that we're smarter or more privileged, that we're well off, you know. They asked one kid, they said, how come you're the captain of the football team? How come the kids all got together and voted you as the captain of the football team? Well, it wasn't because he was smarter. It wasn't because he was more privileged. It wasn't because he was a better football player. It wasn't because he was a leader. It wasn't because he was bigger or better than any other kids. It was because he owned the football. Akartavya is a Sanskrit word which means non-doer. It means non-doer. The key to treating people who serve you with respect and empathizing with their situation is to see yourself as a non-doer. That's called akartavya. When someone does something at their own risk or on their own behalf, there's a sense of proprietorship and therefore there's a reaction. Every one of us experiences this. We act not with detachment, but we all act with a certain fruit, a certain goal, and a certain object in mind. We have a vision that when I get this or do this or this falls into place, I will be sitting pretty and I will be enjoying. And generally, when we envision a goal or a fruit or a target with ourselves as the enjoyer, we overestimate the benefits which will come to us because of that. In almost every case, when we achieve that, the benefits have been inflated and overestimated. It's not really all that it was cracked up to be. But because we're focused, we get a kind of a madness. We get a feverish intentness that I've got to have this. I've got to achieve this result. And as a result, we can very easily be frustrated, we can get angry, and we can get overreact because we're posing ourselves as the center, the central figure of interest here. But devotional service, the practice that we follow, which is known as bhakti yoga, the yoga of love and devotion, we are not posing ourselves as the enjoyers. Like when you sit down, if you're an LDS person and you clasp your hands over a meal and you thank God for that meal and you thank God for friends and you thank God for association, you thank God for health and you thank God for all those things, that's great because gratitude is the noblest of all human emotions. However, the preposition or the presupposition is that God is supplying all this stuff for our enjoyment. That God has nothing better to do than to give us good friends and a good meal and sit us down in a good house and good warm thing. And that when we enjoy, God enjoys through us. But nobody creates, nobody starts a business or a family unless they do it for their own pleasure, their own enjoyment. Like Jerry and Lisa, they have a little boy named Aaron. And that boy, you know, he's a very active boy and they have to watch him all the time and he's a handful. And on one level, he works them hard, but really they enjoy him and they would not, for all the work and all the trouble and over all this, they would not reverse that or unhave him for all the money in the world. Because they enjoy that. He's their boy, and they enjoy parenting him. So similarly, God creates the universe, and he creates us so that he can enjoy parenting us. Everything is made for his enjoyment. It's not just put out there for our enjoyment. Our process, just like RT, she knew just to come in on cue at this very point in time. We discussed this and we worked this out. She just brought the offering plate, the plate of food. Now we can sit down, we can say grace, but before that we're actually going to offer the food to God. God created it, and so God has the first right of enjoyment. He doesn't need to eat matter and chew it and masticate it. But in the Bhagavad Gita, the Song of God, the scripture of India, he says, if you offer me in love and devotion, flower, fruit, leaf, or water, first of all, if you take the trouble to offer those things which God likes, and nowhere does he ask for flesh food, for food which is obtained through bloodshed and screaming and violence. And see, we have even had it worked out so well that after Arti bring in one plate, then Prema brings in the second plate here. Now there's no meat, fish, or eggs on either one of those plates, nor will there ever be on any plates that are ever offered in the temple. Because the Lord doesn't ask for it. And that's the first sign that it's not about us. I may prefer to eat some other food, but Krishna says, I prefer these kinds of food. So as devotees of Krishna, we offer what he asks for and not what we would prefer to have. And that's the first sign that God is in fact the enjoyer and the proprietor. And of course, after it's offered, then we enjoy it as the remnants of foodstuff. The remnants of foodstuffs. Now, normally the word remnants isn't very positive. You know, you might eat and give your bird the remnants or give your dog the remnants. But the remnants of God are divine. There's a special word in Sanskrit. And everybody who's raised in this culture who hears this word feels just really positive emotions when you hear this word. It's called prasadam. Food which has been offered to the Lord, vegetarian, fruit, flour, milk, dairy product, legumes, which have been offered to the Lord, is called prasadam. And even as I look, I see smiles. Jerry, Lisa, Jai Krishna, Jeanette, you know, Alanoth, you know. Just to say that word, prasadam, you know. Big grins, you see what I'm saying? You don't get food, no. Prasadam, it's food which is now consecrated and blessed. And because the Lord has enjoyed it, it has a special flavor that no other food in the world has. And afterwards, when we go on to the feast, you can taste some and just tell me if you don't think that's true. So when we do everything for God, we're not the proprietors, we're not the owners, and we're not attached. And we're changeless in the sense that, you know, whatever happens, whether it be success or failure, my duty is to serve. My duty is not to serve successfully, to serve failure. My duty is to serve. And whatever the outcome is, you can't take that away from me. And so in this way, as the reflection of the sun is unaffected by the water, devotees do not get puffed up by opulence or affluence or privilege. They see it as the mercy of the Lord. They don't see it as anything that they have done in order to achieve that. It's just the mercy of the Lord upon them. And this is a nice image. You see the sun reflecting on the water, and obviously the water is in motion. There's ripples and waves, and especially so as you get closer to the shore. And it may appear that the sunlight is affected by the ripples and waves of the water. But we actually know, objectively speaking, that's not the case, because the sun itself doesn't touch the water. So devotees, you know, as we talked about last week, they experience health problems, they experience financial problems, they experience relational problems, they experience problems just like everyone else, but they're not affected by them because they take it as the mercy of the Lord. And they see their lives as dedicated in service to the Lord. And in this way, they become arkartavya, non-doers and non-reactors. Maharaj Pariksit was also a devotee of the Lord. He was a king, and he dedicated his life to the Lord in the same way that I'm saying. One day he was out in the forest, he was tired and hungry, and he came to the hermitage of a sage, as you see here. The sage was deep in meditation. Now Maharaj Pariksit, by the will of the Lord, interpreted the sage's passivity. He came, and in India the custom is, even if you're a poor man, you always welcome a guest with some nice words and a little bit of water and a place to sit. So the king of the land coming to the ashram of this humble sage did not receive a nice word or a place to sit or any water. And he took it as an insult, and he failed to notice that the sage was oblivious of his externals anyway. He was deep in samadhi. He was deep in meditation. He meant no harm or no insult to the king. But in his mood, and also induced by the Lord, the king was a little bit miffed. But he didn't really overreact. He just did something kind of ironic. He draped a snake around. There was a dead snake nearby, and he draped it around the neck of the sage. And he left, and he went on his way. So he might have reacted a little bit, but, you know, no harm, no foul. And when the sage woke up, he noticed that the snake draped around his neck, and he sort of deduced that he'd failed to offer respect to some visitor. And he understood that out of being slightly put out, a little miffed, the visitor may have garlanded him with a snake. In fact, what you do if you really want to receive a visitor nicely is you put a flower garland around them. When we get sannyasis, Indradyumna Maharaj was here, we would give him flower garlands. And so there's a bit of an irony here that Maharaj Pariksit garland, is, you know, he's the one that should have been garlanded by the host, and failing to do that, he put a garland of a snake around the neck of the host. But they were mature devotees, both of them, and it was no big deal. However, when the 16-year-old son of the saint, who was immature in spiritual life, and nearby he was bathing with some of his friends in the river, when news came to him that the king had done this to a father, he way overreacted. He way, way overreacted. And he brought down a curse upon the king that he would die within 7 days. Now the king, it was an offense, but it was a mild offense, and it was certainly not an offense that merited the death penalty. And yet the boy overreacted to the point that he cursed Lord Maharaj Pariksit to die within 7 days. Way, way, way overreaction. Now, normally this would be the result of someone's karma. Whatever happens to us throughout our day, whatever pains and pleasures come to us, they are the mature fruits of actions performed in the past, either in this life or in previous lives. When you commit a sinful activity, you don't get instant karma. It's just like when you plant a seed. It takes some time for that seed to grow. It may take months or years even, decades. So some of the reactions, the karmic reactions that we're experiencing right now, today, the seeds may have been planted 10, 20, 30 years ago, or even in a past life. But the way to avoid karmic reactions is to always act on behalf of the Lord. When you're acting on behalf of the Lord, you're protected by the Lord. And here's an example. If you kill someone in peacetime, you go to prison and you get life imprisonment or you get the death penalty because you've done it on your own. And therefore, you have to take individual responsibility. And yet, at the same time, there are many Americans in Afghanistan and Iraq who are killing people, and yet there's no punishment. There's no life imprisonment. There's no death penalty for them. So what is the difference? Killing is killing, but these guys are killing for the government, and the government deems that it's best for the safety and the health of Americans that they have to go over there and kill. Not everyone agrees, but anyway, that's the opinion of the government, and the soldiers are executing the order of the government. So there's no reaction for whatever killing they may do over there, because they're acting supposedly for the greatest good and under the greatest authority. Similarly, you see the fire truck here. Imagine a man who's at a cocktail party, gets drunk, he's over the legal level, he's driving over the speed limit, and he runs over a little girl on his way home. Now, he will be prosecuted, very serious crime, vehicular homicide. He could go to and do hard time in a prison for that, because he is doing it on his own, and he has to assume responsibility for his actions. On the other hand, let's say someone works for the municipality, he's a fireman, he's driving a truck to a scene of a fire where he hopes to be able to save lives, and he saved lives in the past, and as he's driving with his lights flashing, a little girl runs out and he hits her accidentally. It's a tragedy. It's a tragedy. At the same time, he's not directly responsible, because he had the best intentions, he was working for the highest authority, and he was working for the greatest good. So when you work for God, and when you dedicate your speaking, and your cooking, as we talked about, and your sewing, and your cleaning, and your construction, and your festivals, when they're not about you, but they're about glorifying God, then there is no karmic reaction. There is no karmic reaction. And if something happens to you, such as what happened to Maharaj Parikshit, it was not as a result of any sin that he did, it was the will of the Lord. Because in those 7 days that he had to live, the whole Srimad Bhagavatam was narrated to him by Shukadeva Goswami, and we are enriched 5,000 years later by that great book of knowledge. Again, and here was the example of Kurukshetra. Arjuna was asked to fight a great battle. Some people think that the Bhagavad Gita was allegorical, and the war of Kurukshetra was a symbolical literary arrangement, you see, to get some point across. But actually, it happened. There were warriors, 6.5 million of them. They assembled at Kurukshetra, the Kauravas on one side, the Pandavas on the other side. They did fight. Most of those soldiers lost their lives. Limbs were severed. Lives were lost. Women were widowed. Children were orphaned. It actually happened. Now, Arjuna caused a lot of that carnage because he was the most lethal warrior on the battlefield. So let's see what the Srimad Bhagavatam, this is the same literature that was narrated to Maharaj Parikshit in the last 7 days of his life. So let's see what the Srimad Bhagavatam says about this situation. Does Arjuna get karma for all this killing? The battle was actually fought by the will of the Supreme Lord Sri Krishna, and only by his will was Yudhisthira placed on the throne of Hastinapura. Yudhisthira is the older brother of Arjuna. Factually, no sin whatsoever touched the Pandavas, who were only the order carriers of the Lord. For others who declare war out of personal interest, the whole responsibility lies on them. Shall I read that once more? For others, let me go back. No sin touched the Pandavas who were the order carriers of the Lord. For others who declare war out of personal interest, the whole responsibility lies on them. And again, who's a yogi? Who's a yogi? Not just some fellow that knows how to contort his body into all kinds of gymnastic positions. A yogi can be a housewife, a yogi can be a student, a yogi can be a teacher, a yogi can be a businessman. But a yogi is a person who realizes the truth of his relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He discovers that pleasure and pain, as well as their interactions, which he attributed to his own self, are actually due to the false ego, which is a product of ignorance. So you want to know how to not to overreact to those who serve you? Just don't be puffed up. Recognize that whatever advantages you have in life, you're just getting the results of past karma. And maybe those who are disadvantaged are experiencing the negative results of past karma. And the whole thing can be very easily switched. Have you ever had a day turn on a dime? Started out with all full of promise, and at the end of the day there was misery and suffering and hospitalization and financial reverses. And I just read on the internet there was a small business, I forget the name of it, but one of their employees didn't know proper security. You know how when you get an email and you download attachments and stuff like that. So one of their employees opened the door for a hacker from somewhere in Europe to come in and take all of their $560,000 savings for this small business. And the bank would not reimburse them because it was the employee's fault, you see. So would that be a good example of someone whose day started out experiencing the result of good karma and then in the end of the day getting a whole bucket load of bad karma? But whatever it is our own responsibility. So if we don't like how the ball bounces, we shouldn't drop it in the first place. And then there's another instance. Those who are engaged in the service of the Lord, same things may appear to happen to them, but they're not happening as a result of karma. Because those who are devotees of the Lord see everything. They do everything on behalf of the Lord, and they see everything that happens to them as the direct will of the Lord. So they're calm and cool and equipoised. And they don't take advantage of others. They offer respect to them. That's how not to overreact. When people serve you, don't be demanding, be understanding. Second thing is when someone disappoints you, be gentle and not judgmental. How many of you have had someone disappoint you in life? How many of you have been disappointed? I mean, everybody disappoints somebody sometime. That should be a song. Everybody disappoints somebody sometime. You can't please all the people all the time. You just can't, you know. At some point, you're going to disappoint your sister. You're going to disappoint your brother. You're going to disappoint your parents. You're going to disappoint your teachers. The politicians are going to disappoint their constituency. It's inevitable. So when that happens, then don't be judgmental. Be gentle. Don't label someone, oh, you jerk, or couldn't you have done better than that? Speak encouragingly. Speak encouragingly and don't judge them. I saw Billy Graham was being interviewed. I saw this on YouTube. Billy Graham was being interviewed by Larry King. And Larry King asked him, what do you think about the idea that Christians are right and everybody else is wrong? What do you think about the idea that some people think they're right and everybody else is wrong? And Billy Graham, one of the greatest spiritualists of this century, he said, I don't judge. I let God judge. So is there anyone in here, because of their bias and their prejudice and their preconceptions, that they just walked in here thinking, we're right and these people don't count because they're not part of my sect or my religion or my little community or my little denomination? Does that sound like anybody here today? And yet Billy Graham, who's far more advanced than any of us, he said, I leave it to God to judge. And do you know why he leaves it to God to judge? Because he doesn't want to be judged. Because if we judge, then we're going to be judged. And frankly, we can't afford that because we're not so lily white. It's not because you're just a card-carrying member of some particular sect or denomination that you get a pass. You're judged by your character and by your attitude. And a puffed up, egotistical, bigoted, hypocritical attitude will be a great deterrent towards advancing in spiritual life and achieving spiritual maturity. So when someone disappoints you, just leave it to God to sort it out. Billy Graham said, I leave it to God. I don't judge. I leave it to God. You see what I'm saying? So let's do that. Let's leave it to God. Let's not judge, lest we be judged. And I believe that's a quote from the Christian Bible also. Accept others who have not attained your level of perfection. They don't have to reach up to your standards to be loved. Now look at this picture here where the man is beating the poor elephant. Because the elephant wouldn't come up to his manufactured human circus performance. The animal's not a circus performer. An animal is a creature of the jungle. An elephant is meant to be in a herd, in a jungle, and be in a natural environment. So the elephant is not conforming to the circus trainer's standards. The elephant is not doing the tricks so that he can put money in his pocket. He's not letting the elephant be what the elephant is. Einstein, when he was in school, he was deemed by his teachers as an underachiever. Even some of his teachers, I would venture to say, called him a moron. And in fact, he's kind of goofy. He looks kind of goofy in this picture with his tongue out. But not everybody learns in the same way. Not everybody learns by reading. Some people learn by experiencing, or some people are better at abstract thinking, or some people just don't like to be told what to do. There are all kinds of people. There's all kinds of variety. God loves variety, and different people learn in different ways. We told this story the other day about a school where you have a squirrel, an eagle, and a rabbit. Okay, the squirrel is good at climbing, the eagle is good at flying, the rabbit's good at running. So let's say the teachers decide the students need to be more well-rounded, you see. So they insist that the eagle runs, that the squirrel flies, and the rabbit climbs. You know, well, what good is that? They all get F's and they get discouraged and some of them drop out of school. Encourage that which in which they're strong, you see. Increase their strengths. And then whatever area we're weak, there are other people who complement us. Recognizing our weaknesses and working on our strengths just helps us to realize that we're meant to live in community, that we're better together. Where I'm weak, you're strong. And where you're strong, I'm weak. So let's get together. Let's get together. Similarly in religion. Those who think their religion, their scripture, their prophet has all the answers are missing the point. That God created various religions, various cultures, various prophets, and they all put together pieces of the puzzle. So when you appreciate it, how other people see God and how other people worship God and how other people express their devotion, you understand more about the nature of God. God is not narrow-minded, denominational, or sectarian. In fact, later on in this slide, Brigham Young says Mormonism is not a doctrine, it's not a dogma, it's not something which is defined within certain parameters. Mormonism is wherever there's truth, wherever there's light, that is Mormonism. Mormonism is truth. Mormonism is light. So have I said anything untrue this evening? Have I said anything, that's just a little, that's not... Have I said anything sectarian? Have I said anything denominational? Have I said anything untrue? If the things that I've said be understanding, not demanding, and when someone disappoints you, be gentle, not judgmental, if those are true, then that is Mormonism. Am I right, Jared? That is Mormonism. So wake up and understand what Mormonism actually is. So accept others who have not attained your level of perfection. They don't have to reach up to your standards to be loved. And the test of this, of our being gentle and not judgmental, the test of this, do you know what the test of it is? That we actually, those of us who are judgmental, we actually become happy when someone messes up. We actually have a secret sense of satisfaction when someone messes up. I told you it was going to happen. I told you, I knew it, and we're actually enjoying their distress. When Arjuna was down and out and confused and inarticulate, he dropped his bow, he was trembling, he'd lost his nerve, Krishna didn't say, come on Arjuna, you know, get with the program, buddy. You know, this is, Krishna was very, very gentle, he lowered his voice an octave, he spoke very, very tactfully and very, very gently to Arjuna. He didn't demand of him. He didn't say, Arjuna, we don't have time for this. There's a battle that's about to take place in 20 minutes and you better get with the program. You don't want to do it? It doesn't matter. I'm God, and I'm telling you to do it, and you don't need reasons. That's all the reason you need to know, is that I'm God and you need to do it. As a parent, sometimes you've answered in that way to your child. Well, why do I have to clean my bed? Or why do I have to wash the dishes? Or why do I have to, you know, do this or that? Because I'm God and you're living under my roof. You know what I'm saying? And that may work once or twice. But after a while, you'll lose the respect of your child. You need to be gentle and you need to explain to them why they need to wash the dishes, do their chores, and why they need to go to school today. Gentle giants get a lot more respect than loud autocrats. A gentle answer quiets anger, a harsh word stirs it up. Wisdom from above is pure, peaceful, gentle, and friendly. And an argumentative spirit indicates an ego problem. Again, from the Mahabharata, and I think we'll wind up here and leave the other ones for another episode. In the Mahabharata, which is a great story of India, and it includes the Bhagavad Gita, there is the old king, Dhritarashtra. He was born blind, and he would have been king except for his blindness. And so he always wished for his sons to become the kings, although the Pandavas, who were born of a father, Dhritarashtra's brother, who was not blind, were the legitimate heirs to the throne. So Dhritarashtra and his sons, headed up by Duryodhana, conspired in so many ways to disenfranchise the Pandavas. They tried to poison them by giving them poisoned food. They burned the house in which the Pandavas were sleeping, hoping to kill them. They kidnapped their wife. They cheated them of their kingdom in a crooked dice game. Every single provocation, every single aggravation, Dhritarashtra and his sons, they leveled towards the Pandavas. And yet, after the war, though Dhritarashtra had done everything he could to elevate his sons over the Pandavas, he still, after all of his sons had died, he still was invited into the palace by Dhritarashtra. He was given respect. This man who had tried to kill Dhritarashtra and all his brothers because he was old, because he was blind, Yudhishthira showed gentleness and showed kindness and grace to him. He didn't put him off in a closet somewhere. He didn't exile him. He didn't put him in jail, which he deserved. But he treated him with kindness and gentleness. Because anyone can change at any time. In fact, when Yudhishthira would go to the chambers of Dhritarashtra in the morning, he would say, "Good morning, O king." Because Dhritarashtra always wanted to be king, but he couldn't be king because he was blind. So Yudhishthira called him king just to make him happy. Even though he wasn't the king, he called him king, and he treated him as king. And when Yudhishthira would make decisions, he would ask the advice of Dhritarashtra. He didn't want to make him feel bad. He didn't want to condemn him. He didn't want to judge him. God will do that. And because of the gentle behavior of Maharaj Yudhishthira, at the end of his life, Dhritarashtra experienced a total change of heart. He had an epiphany. He had a realization of all of his crimes, of all of his sins, of all of his transgressions. He felt deep repentance. He felt shame in the core of his heart. And inspired by his brother Vidura and accompanied by his wife Gandhari, he left the palace without telling anybody, without telling anyone. Vidura said to Dhritarashtra, "Leave, do penances and austerities, repent, you might say, and hope to get free or hope to minimize these karmic reactions. Depend upon the Lord for the removal of your sins. But don't tell anybody, because if you tell Yudhishthira, he'll try to talk you out of it. He'll try to convince you to stay in the palace." And so Dhritarashtra just left, and he didn't say a word to anybody. And when Yudhishthira came in the morning to say, "Good morning, O king," Dhritarashtra was gone. And Yudhishthira said, "Where is he gone?" And he was told, "He just left. He just left because he realized that he's not going to correct himself living in the palace. He needs to correct himself by going to the forest and performing austerities and repenting of all of his actions." And Yudhishthira said, "I'll go after him and I'll beg him to come back." And he was advised not to disturb his uncle by bringing him back home. His uncle was now beyond the modes, beyond material reactions. And from the Bhagavad Gita, these words: "One who is self-controlled and unattached, and who disregards all material enjoyments, can obtain by practice of renunciation the highest stage of freedom from reaction." And the reason I put this image of a forest fire is that's how Dhritarashtra met his end. While he was in the forest performing austerities, a forest fire came by and burned him. And we can imagine that because he'd seen the light, he'd felt remorse for his sins. And at the last stage of his life, he consecrated. It no longer was about him or his sons or his family or his denomination or his sect or his religion. It became ultimately at the end about his relationship with God. And he realized that I have jeopardized my sweet intimate relationship with God by putting myself in the center. And he was able to see things in their proper perspective. That God is the center and we're meant to orbit around him and not the other way around. So at least he, at the last stage of his life, he left home, he left his material attachments, he dedicated himself to the Lord. He went to the forest, and as he was being consumed by the forest fire, he had the names of the Lord on the tip of his tongue. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. And this is the key not to overreacting in life. We'll talk about this more in the next segments, but the key to not overreacting is to realize that everything that we have, whether it be for, quote, good or for bad, is given to us by the Lord, and it is all for our betterment. And we are created, we are fashioned, we are crafted by Him for His service. And we're all unique, and we're all individual, and we all have a part to play. Imagine life is a big jigsaw, and everybody is shaped differently. So we don't say that this piece has no place in the puzzle, you see, or that this piece replaces this piece. Every piece has its own shape, and every piece is needed to make the puzzle complete. So every faith, every religion which is centered around God and love of God, and which has a love and a regard for truth, is part of the puzzle, part of the ultimate plan of the Lord. And those who are in sync with that plan of the Lord are meek and gentle. They're understanding, they're not demanding, they're gentle, they're not judgmental. And we'll talk about some of the other qualities next week. But we'll stop there. Are there any questions or comments?